Again, please help me welcome Brad Miles and Lieutenant John Vanek.
All right. Well, this is incredibly exciting to be here. John and I have both been doing this work in the field for quite a long time. And when you've been doing it for a while, you've gone around the country, you've been at tons of events, and you could kind of compare the different events. And I could honestly say, and I don't just say this to every audience, this is one of the biggest events that I've ever been at in the field. This is one of the most well-organized, best energy, awesome energy and momentum in the room. It just feels incredible to be here. So you all are doing an incredible job. I think the lineup of speakers is great. I think Sarah Grove's concert last night was amazing. Great to meet Jubilee and hear about their work. I'm really looking forward to hearing some of the other speakers, the 30 breakouts. It's kind of staggering. And Betty Ann's done an amazing job. And so John and I, as we were deciding to prepare for this opening session, we were thinking, well, how do you want to do this? I can give a PowerPoint, you can give a PowerPoint. Do you want to speak? Do I want to speak? And we were thinking, we kind of wanted to vary it up a bit and not give the same PowerPoint that we've given. And we wanted to just sit on the stage and really recognize that sometimes when you're working in this field and you do this nonstop, you don't have as much time to just sit and dialogue with other people in the field. John and I have been at conferences where he was speaking and I was speaking, and we actually didn't even talk to each other because we were in different rooms. And so we thought, both for the benefit of all of you, we wanted to think up some questions to ask each other that both we genuinely wanted to know what each other thought about it, but we also thought that it would benefit you all to kind of hear some of those questions. So we're going to kind of do this as a dialogue, and we've both kind of picked our brains of what are some interesting questions we want to ask each other and see kind of what we come up with. And then we want to leave plenty of time for the questions from you all with Betty Ann and the index cards that you talked about. So we're going to limit our questions for each other and then open it up. And then after that, we have an awesome day. There's two other speakers. We have Nathan and then David Batstone and then all the breakouts. So we're excited to kick it off today. So I'm gonna start it off with the first question. So I've been hearing all this stuff around the country about the San Jose Task Force. And people in different communities are talking about the exciting things that the San Jose Task Force is doing. They're talking about John and Jennifer and others' leadership. And so I've met people in the field and they say, what are these human trafficking task forces? What is a task force? What does it do? What does the San Jose Task Force do? And so both for the benefit of everybody, but also just so I could hear, what are some of the updates on the San Jose Task Force? How's it been going, and what is this task force?
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here. And it's a pleasure to have some time with Brad. I think this is probably the first time we've had time to chat face-to-face.
Yes.
Since 2006, when we both happened to be in New Orleans at the National Conference, and we were talking on a bus. But anyway, our task force is one of 40 across the United States that is funded through the U.S. Department of Justice. And briefly, through the Department of Justice and the Office of Justice Programs, you have the Bureau of Justice Assistance, and their job, that agency, they fund law enforcement agencies for a variety of different types of projects, including human trafficking. Also within DOJ, you have the Office for Victims of Crime, and that agency funds service providers. And through some reauthorizations of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act in 2003, Department of Justice was tasked with putting together a multidisciplinary task force system. So there's 40 of us now, ranging from the East Coast, Florida, all across the United States, Alaska, Hawaii, and in Saipan, in the Northern Mariana Islands. We work in partnership with the South Bay Coalition to End Human Trafficking, and they're going to be presenting this afternoon. And the goal of the task force system is to create a multidisciplinary, victim-centered response to human trafficking. And I'll just touch on what we mean by multidisciplinary. We have local law enforcement agencies, for instance, the San Jose Police Department. We have the FBI, ICE, the U.S. Attorney's Office, very strong partnership with the Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office and a variety of other agencies. And then we work with all of our service providers. And this phenomenon of human trafficking cannot be handled by only one agency. So we have to have the support network. I've been, in terms of the San Jose response, I've been very fortunate, and we've been very fortunate to have a tremendous amount of support from our retired chief, Rob Davis, and our current command staff, and I've been given a lot of latitude and ability, and we're grant-funded. So I have to mention your handbooks today and the lanyards. These are provided through the grant funding. And that's a little bit about what we do, just kind of on a surface measure. Come to my breakout this afternoon and learn more.
So, very great to know. And I've heard you say at other conferences that in your 24 years of law enforcement, you've seen that human trafficking is one of the most complicated types of crime that you've ever investigated. So what do you mean by that? And why is human trafficking, if you're investigating all these different types of crime, because this trafficking is not the only thing that John does. John has many other responsibilities, and trafficking is one of the few things he does. So how does this crime match up or measure up to others?
Well, I describe it as being complicated because I think it's very complicated on two or three different levels. The first level is that people understand to come to the police department and say, hey, you know what, I was robbed, I was beaten up. Somebody hacked into my computer and stole my identity. And these can be very difficult cases to investigate. But people come to us. Trafficking, by its very nature, is hidden. And people don't understand what it is, and that includes law enforcement. I'll talk later on this afternoon about a very interesting case here in Fremont where the U.S. Attorney's Office just received a conviction on human trafficking charges. And in the initial report there, the term human trafficking is never seen. And it was an excellent report by an officer doing excellent work. But you could see he just didn't make the connection. So we also have this other level of complication where we have to work with all these different agencies, because when we're working with victims who are foreign nationals, like this case in Fremont, we had to deal with immigration issues. So we're dealing with our law enforcement, our immigration partners in the coalition. We're dealing with federal agencies. We're having to deal with language issues, cultural issues. And then on the last level, maybe not the last, but another level of complication is that just the management and the communication and the collaboration with all these different agencies, with lots of different policies, lots of different chains of command, is a huge hurdle for us to work on also. And this is a constant process of development. Does that answer your question?
It does. And you were saying that the officer who filled out the report was describing something but didn't describe it as trafficking. So my guess is this issue of trafficking, and I think Betty Ann and Charmaine talked on this last night about the Mythbusters, trafficking, still people don't quite get the definition. And people think sometimes it requires movement. Sometimes people think that it only happens in the sex trade. Sometimes people think that it only happens to immigrants. And so it sounds like if you have all these agencies to deal with and you have all these different chains of command, there's a huge likelihood that everyone could be working off of different definitions of trafficking. So for you, can you boil it down for us is from a law enforcement perspective, what is the really concrete just definition of trafficking that you use and that you want everyone in the task force to use to really boil it down for us?
You bet. So it's easy for us because as law enforcement officials, we have to deal with the law. So the federal definition, to make things simple, for human trafficking is the obtaining, harboring, provisioning, the movement of a person, although movement can be from here to here, essentially the obtaining of a person, and then through force, fraud, or coercion, you obtain forced labor or services or sexual exploitation. The caveat to the federal law being that if we're talking sexual exploitation and the victims are under the age of 18, we do not need to prove that force, fraud, or coercion.
So it sounds like what I'm hearing from you is you're focusing more on the force, fraud, or coercion element, less on the movement element. And that if people get off on this kind of red herring of movement of, well, the victim was brought from Cambodia to Thailand, or the victim was brought from Brazil to here, that's not really the essence. The essence is the force, fraud, or the coercion.
That's exactly right. And there's a lot of confusion because not only are we dealing with federal law at times, but we can be dealing with state law. And I'm going to be asking you some questions about this in a bit. But the state laws vary, and in fact, unfortunately, right now, not every state in the United States has their own anti-trafficking laws. So there's a lot of layers to this, and so what we really do focus on is looking for that force, fraud, or coercion, and it can be extremely, extremely slight.
And so the other thing that we're sensing from other parts around the country is that the movement against trafficking here in the Bay Area is really exploding. Like there's new groups coming up. We have so many groups at the expo table. There's 32 breakout sessions. There's something going on in the Bay Area where the group of folks working on trafficking the Bay Area with you, with IJM, Not For Sale, the Bay Area Anti-Trafficking Coalition, with Charmaine's work, with all the task forces, there's something in the juice out here in the Bay Area that's just exploding the movement. And with all these new groups that are popping up and all these new volunteers that are coming into the field and this new kind of burgeoning awareness, you've been doing this for a bunch of years. What advice would you give to all these new groups? And what would you say as you're entering this field? Here's some of the words that I'd like to share with you as you're emerging.
Pay attention here at the Freedom Summit. A lot of people enter the field with a very small amount of knowledge, and that's great. I mean, we all do. I don't want to tell you how little I knew when I got involved, but there's enough level of infrastructure, there's enough level, there's so many people that are doing things, that what I think it really is important is to really educate yourself about what's going on where you are right now. So if you want to be involved and take a role in anti-trafficking activities here in the Bay Area, work with the organizations that are here to learn what's being done now, and then look for the gaps, because the gaps exist, and they are not just in the areas of finding traffickers or rescuing victims. I have to tell you, as a little plug for, I have a little blog, and I wrote last night, about midnight, how impressed I was with all of the volunteers here. And my point to all of you who are volunteering today is that your work here, the quality of this program that Brad mentioned, will directly lead to rescuing a victim of trafficking, and you deserve the credit for that, and you have my thanks.
Yeah, that's huge, and I really echo what John is saying there, because it's kind of interesting, and Charmaine was saying this a bit last night, right? She was saying that when people think of crime, they think of it as only law enforcement's responsibility to work on crime. And what law enforcement is saying is, no, it's not just our responsibility. We want all the community members to help pitch in to help us fight crime with neighborhood watches and giving us tips and things like that. I think the same dynamic applies in the anti-trafficking field. So sometimes people think, well, the folks who are really fighting trafficking are the folks who do this full time. The folks who do this with the San Jose Police Department, the folks who do this with Polaris, and what is it really for us to do because y'all are the ones working on trafficking? Whereas if you ask the people who are in the field working on this full time, just like Charmaine said, they'll flip it back and they'll say, actually, even though we do this full time, we are so hungry for more people to join the movement. We're so aware every single day that our power is limited when we don't have community members helping out with state laws, community members calling the national hotline, community members helping to identify victims, all those different things. And so we're sitting here saying we're hungry for more help and we're hungry for an army of new volunteers. And then sometimes volunteers are saying, how can we help? Because you guys are doing the work. And so I think I really echo what John just said in terms of take it from two people who kind of work on this day in and day out, and the message that we're sharing is what you all are doing here today of figuring out all the ways to take action, 10 minutes, 10 days, 10 months, that's exactly what the movement needs. And I think Betty Ann's leadership and the leadership of this conference is spot on the money of we're going to turn this into action because that's really, really what the movement needs.
So Brad, with that, let me ask you a couple questions.
Sure.
In a minute or two, or maybe three, tell us what you think were some of the major developments in the anti-trafficking field last year.
So the field is really growing. And 2010 was a huge, huge year for the anti-trafficking field. We're kind of growing exponentially. So I'll give you a couple examples of that. First off, new big cases are starting to break, where the feds and the law enforcement response and the community response is getting smarter at finding trafficking. And last year, the biggest case in U.S. history was ever discovered. It was this case that was first based in Hawaii called Global Horizons. And then they found out that these farm workers were actually being forced to work at these farms in 6 or 7 states. And it turned in from something that they thought was just a couple, you know, 20 or 30 workers, turned into a 600 worker case. And so that's one of the biggest, biggest cases in U.S. history, and we think that's just the tip of the iceberg. And now we're getting smart enough to discover cases like Global Horizons. We're going to be able to see it in other places. Another thing that happened last year that was huge was a lot of us had realized in the trafficking field that the place where most sex traffickers were selling the women and girls under their control was Craigslist. The website that we all use for finding a tennis racket or renting a couch, there's this little section on Craigslist called Adult Services or Erotic Services, and traffickers had basically figured out if we put the women and girls up for sale on Craigslist, it has millions of visitors every day. Surely people are going to find, you know, this is where we're selling women and girls. So all of a sudden, if you talk to law enforcement across the country, they'll tell you the number one platform for buying and selling sex had become Craigslist, which was shocking. And so there's this huge campaign last year of folks kind of calling out Craigslist and saying, Craigslist, do the right thing, not, you know, quit facilitating this. And ultimately there was protests, there was media, there was law enforcement letters, there was all these people, and it mounted up enough pressure that finally Craigslist just said, you know what, it's not worth it. And they took down that adult services section, which was huge. It was huge. They took down the adult services section, and then they took down that same section from everywhere around the world. And what that did, I don't think a lot of people realize how huge that was. There's a group that estimates the total revenue of online sex ads through every single online sex ad company across the U.S. And they had estimated that if you added up all of the online sex ad places, Craigslist was 50% of the market. And so by Craigslist shutting down its doors, it's like we just took the beast that is online selling of sex ads, many of which are trafficking, and just lopped it in half. And so that was huge. But that wouldn't have happened without community pressure. It wouldn't have happened without all of that advocacy. Another thing that I'd say is political will on this issue is extremely high right now. President Obama is making the issue a priority by declaring January Human Trafficking Awareness Month. All these cabinet secretaries, like Secretary Clinton of the Secretary of State, is doing initiatives on trafficking. Secretary Solis of the Department of Labor is doing initiatives on trafficking. Secretary Napolitano of the Department of Homeland Security is doing initiatives on trafficking. So when you have this much political buy-in, this is the year to really leverage that buy-in and take it for a spin. And so we need to figure out how to take all this high-level political will and plug it into something.
Excellent. So let's kind of drill down to the Polaris Project for a second then, because a lot of what you are able to do is driven by that the political will and also by the assistance of the public.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about the Polaris Project and kind of an overview of what your programs are. But everybody has this nifty lanyard with the hotline number on it.
That's right.
And I'd like you to take a couple minutes and explain a little bit more about the hotline, what it does, and just sort of the workflow, because you have some great people in your office that we work with, and
sure,
where we go from there.
I'll jump into that. So just briefly about Polaris, a couple quick things. So Polaris are based in Washington, D.C., and we try to be kind of a one-stop shop for all different types of work working on trafficking. So we take this really comprehensive approach. So there's a part of Polaris that's focused on aftercare, victim services. And we have social workers on staff. Whenever the police raid a brothel, they usually need a nonprofit to be there on site quickly. So we go out with the police in D.C. and Newark, New Jersey. Right now we're serving about 80 victims. And we serve sex trafficking, labor trafficking, adults, kids, U.S. citizens, foreign-born. We try to serve all of it. So there's a whole wing of Polaris that's kind of the aftercare wing. But then we realized, okay, so we're serving the victims, but what are we doing on the long term to really dry up the flow in the first place. So we launched this whole policy department. And the policy department is focusing on improving state laws in all 50 states. And it's functioning like a central hub of state policy advocacy. So already this year, there's been 30 state bills that have been introduced on trafficking in different state legislatures. So it's an exciting year. It really is. So we have this whole policy wing. Then we have this training wing, because if you think about the issue of trafficking, we're all getting trained here today. But imagine all the people that we work with that haven't gotten that training yet. Nurses, doctors, postal workers, folks who process immigration applications, folks who investigate child abuse in the home. Imagine how much training needs to happen. So we have this whole training wing. And then when all those programs are really starting to hum, the U.S. government basically came up with this idea of this huge national hotline and said, who can be there 24/7 to answer all these questions across the country in 170 languages, any question on any topic? You have to really be diverse and be able to handle all of that, as well as handle victims calling, so you have to know about aftercare. So it was a huge application, which Polaris wound up being selected for. So since 2007, we've been doing the national hotline for the country. So when you call this number here on your lanyard, there's a Polaris staff sitting there in the office today ready to answer those calls. So it's been a huge journey, and I think what it's given us a really unique platform to keep our finger on the pulse of all the types of calls that are coming in. So we could be like, wow, we just got 5 calls this past week about people calling in about skincare products being sold at kiosks out of malls from the Israeli Dead Sea. What's going on with skincare products, and why are we getting these 5 calls all of a sudden? Then we get a bunch of calls from people calling in and saying they're all being advertised on this new website called Backpage.com. So what's going on with Backpage? Then we get calls about these Chinese buffets and Indian buffets and workers being shuttled around on these 24-hour buffets, and they have these $30,000 debts over their head. So by being on the national hotline, we can kind of have this bird's eye view to see the changes in the calls and what's coming in. And it's been a fascinating chance to learn about and really see how the field is developing. So that's another program that we do at Polaris. Interesting. So John, I'm talking too much, and I'm gonna bump it back to you. The San Jose Task Force has really been making some great strides, and in D.C. we hear it being talked about you know, what's this exciting thing that this task force is doing, and it sounds like you're really making a huge impact out here. So what are some of the things that you'd say you're most proud of? And what are some of your biggest impact accomplishments where you're like, we really nailed it on that one?
Sometimes you get the sense that, you know, you hit the grand slam, and you don't, in my opinion. This is, if we use baseball an analogy, this is hitting singles and doubles on occasion. It's batting for average, and it is the long-term partnerships that we all have a chance to initiate and foster over years and years. And that's really, I think, where we get mentioned. It's certainly not my work. It is the work of Jennifer Dotzler, who is an officer and investigator for the task force. She'll be speaking this afternoon. It is our associations with Not For Sale campaign. It is one of the things I'm really proud of this year is we got contacted by a doctor, Amy Grace. She'll be presenting this afternoon also about healthcare, and she partnered with us, and through Stanford Hospital, she is reaching out into the emergency rooms of Bay Area hospitals so she and Jennifer can come in together and talk about how ER docs might identify human trafficking victims. Mm. It is this constant pressure. It's just pushing forward little by little, all the time, and having people that are committed to that. And I'm going to kind of segue into the hotline a little bit, because people also, I think, are curious, what happens, what do you do with that information?
So when we send it to you, we email you and say, we just got a tip from this ER doc, What do you do then on your end? We pass the baton to you. What do you do then?
Well, you pass it to Jennifer, and Jennifer goes off and does what Jennifer does. So you got to go talk to Jennifer because she's just a tremendously experienced investigator. And so depending on the information, so frankly, sometimes it'll be an email. But I'd like to point out one case we had earlier, well, about a year ago. I actually got a phone call from Morrill, who is one of your workers at Polaris Project, and this required a phone call. And at the time, I happened to be in Los Angeles working on another human trafficking project, and we had a woman on a street corner in Sunnyvale who had fled a trafficking situation. She was a trafficking victim, and she needed help right then and there and now. And I hooked up my phone and called Perla Flores, who will be presenting this afternoon. She's the co-chair of the South Bay Coalition to End Human Trafficking. And she contacted, Perla is working out of Morgan Hill, made phone calls to people that went to the street corner and helped this woman. We then connect up with Lynette Parker, another good partner of ours who will be presenting this afternoon. See, we're all connected, who is an immigration attorney with the Catherine and George Alexander Community Law Center. And so the whole team comes into play. It has to be that multidisciplinary response.
That is awesome. There's a woman standing on a street corner somewhere. She calls the national hotline, and somehow with a phone tree between us to you, you to Jennifer, Jennifer to Perla, all the other people, someone shows up on that street corner to pick that woman up. That is amazing. That really is amazing. And I think that the challenge from our end on the national hotline is just that. It's that we can get a call from someone that says, I'm a student, can you help me with my paper? We could get another call from someone that says, I'd like a training on human trafficking. Or we could pick up the phone and it's someone saying, I'm on a street corner, I just escaped from a situation, how can you help? And the calls really range. But for those subset of calls where you need a crisis response, you'd be amazed to see the amount of partnerships that have been built nationally so that that emergency response mechanism is in place. And there's kind of this national safety net that's sitting there waiting to kick into action whenever victims get found. So I would really encourage you all to figure out ways. The thing that I've been kind of the drumbeat that I've been saying is, how do we get the hotline number out there more? So how do we get more people to begin calling? Because what we've seen on the national hotline is the more people who call, the more victims get identified. It's that simple. And so it's a really simple recipe for me, that more calls equal more victims, and to get more calls, we need more people putting the number out there.
And Brad, before I think Betty answered to ask us some questions, but one of the things that I would stress about the hotline that you understand, I think this is critical, is that the commitment that people give to the hotline, I believe, is probably relative to some degree. Each area of the country that has an anti-trafficking response that is associating with Polaris and the hotline, we can give, we meaning myself personally, I can decide what contact numbers, what ways they can reach out to me at any time of the day or night, weekends, whether I'm on duty or off duty, the same with Jennifer. And they have the ability to start drilling down until they find somebody. And as long as there are people who are committed to doing the work and are able to do the work, the hotline is just a tremendous tool. It is the, in my opinion, it is the only hotline number we need in the United States.
Thanks, sir.
How about it for Brad and John? When they asked you who's your table of 10 you want to invite to dinner in your lifetime, I know these two guys are invited to mine. So I get to ask you a few questions at this point. But I would like everyone to know that if you're wondering what the Bay Area Anti-Trafficking Coalition will be doing between now and the next Freedom Summit, I'll be answering all your questions, because we got a wonderful response. So please know that we are going to put a question and answer, a little chat side up on our website, freedom-summit.org. We will try and address everyone's questions there, and we will target those to our speakers and ask them to give us responses. So we definitely invite you to check back on our website in a few days. But in the time we have together right now, I would love to start a bit with a few questions I have. One of them is, we have realized that some of your questions are saying, what can I do? What can I do in my community? And we realize we've asked you for your questions before we get to our breakout sessions. So that is where a lot of your questions are going to be answered. So we are excited for the morning we have ahead of us still. But I would love to talk about one thing about getting the news out. You mentioned more victims are rescued the more people call the hotline. We have a question here. Why do you think the issue of human trafficking doesn't get more media coverage? Why isn't the media taking this up as their cause? Perhaps you could speak to the CNN special that's going to be on tomorrow night.
Sure. I think it's a great question. And I think that it's true, the media in this field has not really exploded the way that we've been hoping. And I think that we're on the brink of that being about to change. And I could tell you, I was in New York 2 days ago, and we met with the New York Times, then we met with the Wall Street Journal, then we met with HBO, then we met with MSNBC, then we met with People Magazine, then we met with CNN. Like, the media is about to really hit big. CNN is starting to talk about they might want to dedicate a year's worth of programming to human trafficking in 2011, which could be huge. MSNBC wants to do a couple specials. Dateline wants to do a special. CNN is putting on this huge special on Sunday night, and it's going to air Sunday night at 5 o'clock on the West Coast. So I'd encourage you all to watch it. It's going to be an hour-long special, and it's going to focus on exactly what we're talking about today. How is this happening in America? And is this happening in America? And who are these 13-year-old girls that are being sold for sex on Backpage? And so it's really an hour long of programming, which is going to be huge. But I think you're right. And I think that the media hasn't been as engaged on the topic. Maybe it's a dark subject. Maybe there wasn't a constituency. But now that the media is sensing that you put articles out there and this is something people are hungry to hear about, they're going to respond to that. And so I think we're going to see a big uptick in media around this issue in 2011. And my hope, from my own hotline perspective, is that every story on human trafficking includes the hotline. So I'm watching that clip, and I'm like, great clip on the conference last night, amazing footage, where's the hotline? And so for me, I have like a monomaniacal focus of getting the hotline out there, because whether or not it's Polaris doing it or whether or not it's someone else doing the hotline, that's not as much my concern. My concern is I know that the hotline leads to more victims getting identified. I just know that. And so for me, I'm hungry to get it out there because I'm hungry to find more victims that are in those situations.
Thanks. Well, speaking of another kind of media, we did talk a little bit last night about children being solicited online, and you mentioned it again here today with the Craigslist victory. We have a question here that says, can you explain how children are solicited online in the sense of, don't they still have to travel to a destination and be physically present to be abused? I don't understand how online transactions might hurt them or how that's called human trafficking.
I'll take that. This starts touching on this really broad, again, kind of a confusing issue sometimes, because what's important to realize is that when a crime is investigated, or when prosecuted, or certainly when a victim is rescued, it may include trafficking, it may not. Just because you don't hear the term human trafficking used doesn't mean that wasn't some element, and it certainly doesn't mean that the offenders were not prosecuted for other types of crime. And quite often, charging offenders with other violations is much more effective because the sentencing can be so much greater. So, you get a child online, certainly any exchange of child pornographic material, that's a crime. It's a crime, leave it at that. But eventually, if you know, we can lure a child to a place and then they are then sold and exploited, now we have trafficking. But we don't even have to have that component to have other types of crime. And sort of in this big picture, kind of touching on the media question also, is that it's important to realize that there's always this work going on and victims are being rescued every single day. And you don't hear about them because there may not be a criminal prosecution associated with them being rescued. There may be legal reasons why the information is not put out in public. But this is going on all the time.
The one thing that I'd add in there is I would just supplement what John said by saying, I think the traffickers have realized that when you put a child up for sale online, there is a huge demand out there of people willing to buy that child, which is a scary thought. And there was a study that was done in Georgia, and it really shook the trafficking field to the core when the findings came out, because all of us were so floored by these findings. This group of researchers decided to see how many Johns are actually calling these ads that are posting for children. So they took a couple decoy ads and they put up the ads on Craigslist, and they had a little cell phone that was being answered by graduate students. And it said, you know, young girl for sale or whatever else. So all of a sudden, the phone started ringing, and these grad students started answering the phone. And they were actually talking to these Johns who were seeking to buy sex directly from these kids. And so what the study tried to figure out was, would the Johns be deterred by the fact if they were told that it was definitely a child? So they had the grad students give a series of three warnings. The first warning was, sir, I just got to let you know, this person might be a child. And the John kind of said, okay, you know, thanks for letting me know. And then the second warning was a little bit more harsh. In my personal opinion, I've taken a look at her, and I think she is a child. And the John's like, okay, thanks for letting me know. And the third warning was, I'm sorry I haven't been totally candid with you. I just want to come out and say she definitely is a child. This child is 15 years old that you're about to come meet. And what they learned was, of the 200 Johns that they studied who called into one of their decoy ads, 46% of them would have gone through with the transaction all the way past the third warning. And that's a scary, scary, scary thought, because it revealed a little glimpse of what's going on in the sex trade that we're not really seeing. And so traffickers have figured out that that phenomenon is real, and that the sexualization of young girls in our culture is increasing. You got Miley Cyrus on a pole, and you got Bratz dolls and all this stuff. The sexualization of young girls is increasing, and that is creating this demand for men to have sex with younger and younger looking girls. And so when you put an ad online that shows a very young looking girl, it's gonna explode with phone calls. And that's how traffickers have figured out. So it's a scary thing that we really need to take a look at.
Do you wanna speak a minute to your breakout session on demand?
Sure. So a lot of folks say, if we're getting to root causes, what are the root causes that's driving this behavior? On labor trafficking, what's the root cause of why people are being forced to labor against their will? In sex trafficking, what's the root cause of why people are being sex trafficked? And what I think the field is realizing is the root cause is demand. And that on the labor trafficking side, people are demanding cheap products without asking questions of what went into making them. And on the sex trafficking side, men are demanding to buy sex with women or girls. And so sex traffickers are basically just the profiteers that are looking to jump on those profits, and they seize a market opportunity. So there's a whole discussion that this field needs to have around how to make buying sex uncool, and how to make our society a society that is totally inoculated against buying sex, to the same way that we've had an anti-smoking campaign or a wear your seatbelt campaign. That's going to start to happen in 2011. And so the breakout later will just talk about what are some of those methods.
I feel like some of those transactions you're mentioning online are the things that we might not see between a trafficker and someone that is being abused. But we are getting a lot of questions around, obviously, how do I recognize these things in my community? David Badstone from Not For Sale campaign will be up here in a little while, and I remember him saying, you know, there's massage parlors everywhere, but once in a while you can even look for, instead of saying, oh, a neighborhood has bars on the outside of the windows, so the people can't get in, there are actually establishments where the barbed wire or the bars are on the inside so that people can't get out, as one of the signs. But I wondered if, John Vanek, if you could speak a bit to, when we say be the eyes and the ears, can you nail that down a little bit into what we're looking for on the street?
Well, the first thing I would say is that, unfortunately, many of my colleagues in law enforcement will say, oh, we don't have human trafficking in our jurisdiction. If you don't see it, it's because you're not looking for it. It exists in every neighborhood, no matter how affluent, no matter the socioeconomics and the cultural background of the people who are living there. we can give some probably fairly more simple indicators of potential trafficking when we're looking at the sexual exploitation side, as you mentioned. Front businesses like massage parlors, residential brothels where you see lots of men coming and women there, and it just doesn't appear to be right. Those are really clear indicators. And all it takes is a phone call. It's really more, I think, about being aware. Now, it gets a little trickier when we start looking at some of these domestic servitude cases and other types of forced labor that we've had, particularly in our area. We've this case recently in Fremont. This woman was held in a house in Fremont for a year and was only allowed outside the house on two occasions. Now, if that person was in my neighborhood, I might find that just a little curious that somebody is never outside. There was a case in Southern California a few years ago. A young girl was brought from Egypt, and she was the house slave. She took care of children who were her own age. They were well-dressed. These were affluent people living in a nice house, and she was dressed in rags and sleeping basically on a dog bed in the garage with a 5-gallon bucket to use as her toilet. People in her neighborhood saw that, and ultimately somebody called it in.
We, Polaris, we just launched a new website about 3 days ago. And if you go to polarisproject.org, one of the things that we decided to put on there, because we get this question so often of what are the signs to look for, we put a page on there that just says recognizing the signs. And there's a lot of different places to look. There's the Polaris website, there's government wallet cards, there's a lot of people who put out some really good material on recognizing the signs, but that's one place to check out to see the whole list of recognizing the signs. And we put like 50 bullets on there that could be useful.
Thank you. Can you please help me again in thanking Brad Miles and Lieutenant John Vanek? Thanks, guys. Tip of the iceberg. Yeah, that'd be great. Wow, well, that really feels like the tip of the iceberg, but there is so much more to come today. I like that Brad mentioned there at the end the new website they just launched 3 days ago, and Jubilee, who was up here this morning. On the musical side of things, their CD literally just arrived yesterday, and it's got in its outer pocket 5 ways to fight slavery. You can tell that this movement, even the media coverage as we talked, is just kind of launching, and you are all a part of that. So I think one of the things I always like to reiterate is please don't feel like you're late to the game or that everybody else has got it figured out and that you're day late, dollar short. This is really a case where we are learning together and we are walking together in this. One example of that would actually be that we planned this January 21st, 22nd, before President Obama decided to make January Human Trafficking Awareness Month. So that worked out pretty well, didn't it? Next up, we would love to keep your attention here. We're going to go hard until 11, but if anybody does need to use the restrooms or whatnot, but we are going to keep on rolling until 11 before we send you out for breakouts. We are so pleased to have Nathan George with us here from Trade as One. Nathan and his team have been in the back lobby as part of the group selling fair trade products. I have learned so much from Nathan, not only about his own personal conviction about speaking to people all over the country about their consumer spending habits, but when people come to me and they say, this seems like such a big issue, or I'm this or that, I'm that, and I don't know how I can fight it, one of the things that he helps us recognize, and he has a very powerful way of doing it, is that we can all make better consumer choices that actually can help fight this issue, just by not choosing products that are actually made off of slave labor. So I don't want to steal his thunder by any means because he's got a lot to teach us this morning. So with no further delay, please help me welcome Nathan George.
Thanks, Betty Ann.
Thanks.
Great. Thanks so much. Well, as soon as I open my mouth, you're going to know I'm not from around here. I'm from that brutally repressive regime from which you all won your freedom a couple of hundred years ago. And by the way, if I do pronounce things differently to, if I'm in the South, I'll say all y'all. It's because I'm doing it correctly, okay? It's called English. Well, Thank you for your welcome, Betty Ann. It's just fabulous to be here. As I thought about what to talk about, I'm not going to talk this morning about human slavery. I'm not even going to talk about, because you've got David Batstow coming up after this, and far more qualified people than me to talk on the subject. I'm not even going to talk about how, as consumers, we can very powerfully and do something very practically every single day to provide a way for victims of human slavery to sustainably stay out of it, to provide a way to keep people out of slavery, and to speak prophetically to a marketplace that says, it is not okay for you to give me a product at a low price if the price comes at the price of somebody enslaved. So what I want to do this morning is just take a few minutes to talk about something far more personal. And Betty Ann mentioned yesterday, the whole purpose of this conference is to move us from conviction into action. And we're going to get practical ideas of what to do, as she said, throughout all the workshops for the rest of the day. What I actually want to do is look at, this conference will only be as effective as the changes that it's going to bring about. And those changes go on first and foremost and most importantly inside of our hearts and inside of our minds. And those changes occur here at this conference. A guy called Parker Palmer is a Quaker, an author, an activist, and he talks about something that I want to just spend a few minutes talking about this morning. And he calls this thing the tragic gap. And the gap is between how the world is now in all of its brokenness and how we imagine that it could be. And this is not just a naive kind of fantasy imagining, because we've seen expressions of it. We've actually seen slavery abolished. We thought the job was done. And it's not fantasy, because we've seen forgiveness and reconciliation happen, because every now and again, it happens, even in the most unspeakable tragedies of genocide. And we've seen examples of the equitable sharing of resources. Every now and again, it happens. So we can imagine a different world. But he says that real change is brought about only by people who stand in this tragic gap. And you live in that tension between facing the reality of what we have today and dreaming of the future. And that tension breaks your heart and it opens up your mind. And it's so, we can go there, but it's so hard to stay there and to live there. Because the temptation is always to flip-flop on one side or the other. Either looking at too much reality, and the gruesomeness of that sometimes leads to a corrosive cynicism that says, well, what can I do? Human beings have been abusing each other since time began. It is what it is. I really can't make that much of a difference. Or, on the other side, you have this kind of heady, kind of irrelevant idealism. And I live in Santa Cruz, so, often this idealism comes accompanied by some 1960s music and tie-dyed Indian cotton and the faint whiff of marijuana. And these two extremes actually do the same thing. They take us out of the game. They move us out of action. To move things forward, you have to stand and you have to stay in this painful, tragic gap, as Parker Palmer calls it. So what are some of the things we need to know about staying in that gap? And that's what I want to talk about. Firstly, it requires this personal journey. And to some extent, each one of us, just by virtue of the fact we're in this room, are on some kind of a journey like that. If we stand in that gap, we will have our hearts and our minds opened. We need to look that reality in the face. We need to educate ourselves. We need to go and smell what $1 a day smells like. We need to immerse ourselves in that reality. We also need to ask ourselves some very, very searching questions, and these are very difficult. How do we do everything we know how to do to not collaborate with evil, to not condone evil, to not profit from evil, while at the same time recognizing that our lives are inextricably linked and bound up in systems and ways of living that include evil. It's a very tough thing to go through. But secondly, we can't do this alone. We examine ourselves and we measure what response we want to make. But to stand and to stay in this gap, it has to be done in community. And kind of community is a kind of trendy, it's almost a word that almost doesn't mean anything. But there is no social movement that has ever taken place that's ever been brought about by the acts of one individual. The abolition of slavery in Great Britain, led by that unstoppable force of William Wilberforce, was only brought about because he was part of the Clapham sect. And one of the key events in my journey occurred in that very church on Clapham Common, where that sect met and worshipped and plotted and planned everything that they were doing. Courageous individuals gather together in communities and support groups that help keep that vision alive and that spur those individuals on to make extraordinarily courageous decisions and acts. So there is this solitary journey that we all have to go through about being truthful about ourselves, but there is also this corporate journey that we have to join. And I don't know what that looks like for you, what that community is for you. For me, I have a group of individuals that are around me that support me. One is helps me spiritually as I walk on the walk that I'm on, to see things through biblical lenses and to see things perhaps the way God sees them. And that conversation sometimes is very painful, and I argue with this person. And I don't like listening to some of the things that he has to say. I have business mentors who, from monthly to quarterly to annually, I have different people that I interact with over different time periods that speak truth and sometimes uncomfortable truth to me. And one of the things, right at the beginning of my journey, many years ago, when I was considering what I was going to do, one of the messages there was, "You're not ready, Nathan. You must not jump into action right now. You've got more to learn." And it took 2 years of sitting in a dark room with a wet towel on my head, reading things and networking with people. I didn't want to hear that. But that community around you is so important to speak truth, not just to speak things that we want to hear, but to speak truth into our lives. And we are, you know, I think this is one of the things we're very bad at in this generation. We're remarkably weak at this corporate truth-telling. Everyone is so individualistic, and the temptation is to run off and start something new before we've examined the landscape. And, you know, part of today is just looking around, looking at the landscape. So do avail yourself of all of that. The third thing, and this may be the most important thing, is that it involves sacrifice. We want results, we want them fast, we want impact, we want it to be big, we want change, but we don't want it to cost us too much. There's actually a term for that, it's called slacktivism. And, you know, it's fine to wear wristbands and to join Facebook groups and all of that, and I do that. It's important to get awareness out and to be part of these wider movements, but if that's where it stops, let's not kid ourselves. The forces that enslave people are very powerful and evil, and they will only be overcome through selfless sacrifice. And even then, they may not budge. And as we examine ourselves, I guess the question we need to ask is, am I willing to let go of my sense of achievement? I loved what Sarah Groves said yesterday about the long defeat. Will I be content with anonymity for years? Will I accept a much lower standard of living? Or am I shackled to some hamster wheel that I don't think I can get off? Am I prepared to live my whole life without seeing the results of my dream? See, I think this is very subversive talk because we are brought up to believe we can do anything. We can have huge impact. And there is some truth in that, of course. But we will only confront the forces of evil and bring about change through long-term, committed, selfless sacrifice. I live in Santa Cruz, as I said. I have a redwood tree outside my house that was planted when the house was built 100 years ago. So it's a big tree. And in tall winds, it's actually quite disturbing to think it might land on us and there would be no Georges anymore. But one of the things I love doing is going up into the Santa Cruz Mountains, going to Big Basin State Park, and just walking amongst the redwoods there, trees that are 300 feet tall, that are older than Jesus. I mean, I know theologically that's not correct, okay? But you know what I mean. They're more than 2,000 years old. And what comes over me is this sense of awe. And when you're in the silence and you're amongst these things that are 2,000 years old, it's like that sense of awe I get when I'm in the cathedrals back in Europe. And where we used to live in England, the closest one was 15 miles away. It was Winchester Cathedral. Winchester Cathedral is 1,100 years old. It took 150 years to build. The people who stood in the gap of what was and what they dreamed to be, they never saw it completed, and yet they did it. And now, 1,000 years after they've died, it is still standing as a testament of the vision of a place that glorifies God. So much so that when you walk through the doors, just intentionally by design and attention to detail, it immediately subdues the arrogance of man with its sense of awe and wonder. Let me share with you some of the brokenness from which I've come. I've spent 18 years in the software industry, and I've always been very personally motivated to achieve things. That's just kind of how I'm wired up. I guess it's partly to do with being a guy as well, but I want impact. I believe the notion that success is up to you, it's measurable, and that you fail to achieve success if it isn't scalable and profitable and has widespread impact and has an impact fast. And by fast, I mean if it takes you more than 3 years, you're a loser. I've lived kind of reaching out for the future, achieving things, building something new, and getting rewarded for that. That's a system that, you know, climbing that greasy pole of a career, that's a system you get rewarded for. And then at the age of 35, I began to get exposed to the brokenness, the reality of this world. And I took some time off. And the brokenness you can't see when you're on an aircraft all the time, and when your diary is full, your calendar is full of busyness, and you're honking your horn for someone to get out of the fast lane because you're late for a meeting and all of that. You can't see the brokenness. So I took some time off and I just went and I sat and had table fellowship with people on $1 a day. And I smelt what $1 a day means. And I met women who, still very broken, had been taken out of commercial sex work and human trafficking. I met saints who had and still are devoting their whole lives to nothing glamorous except the physical care of people with HIV/AIDS and then watching them die. My life seems so hollow and shallow. As you stand in that gap, it will break your heart. And as a good type A person, well, I'm not sure I completely fit that description, I set about investigating what could I do as a business person about these issues, and I became and still am passionately convinced about the essential role of jobs and business and commerce in restoring the lives of the poor and the abused. Because after all of the fabulous work that is done about raising awareness and intervention and rescuing people, if we do not have a sustainable way of life for them after that, they are just as vulnerable as they ever were. And so business has an essential function to play in that rehabilitation. But as I became convinced of that, we took this kind of crazy risk of resigning from my job in the UK and moving the family with our three boys over to the US and starting Traders One, because I tried to get other organizations to do what I thought needed to be done. So that's kind of how I'm wired up. And one of the people that has been part of this kind of support backpack group of mine that I've had, I met on this journey, and I met him last October, and he sensed this kind of impatience for impact in me. And he knew Mother Teresa well. And so in October, he said to me something that just really arrested me. He said, and he speaks very slowly, "You know, Nathan, Mother Teresa was a saint not because of her impact. She actually had very little impact on the global poor. She didn't achieve that much. She's a saint not because she influenced nations or big social movements. She was a saint because every single day she woke up and she just faithfully did what she believed she was called to do. And you need to become comfortable with just being faithful. Success or otherwise, results are in God's hands. You just be faithful. You offer your life, and He takes that life and does whatever He wants with it. That's the deal. You don't get to write the script." Now, please hear me. I'm not saying, you know, I don't want to dampen people's enthusiasm for action. You know, there are all sorts of things each one of us can do in response to the issues of human slavery. And taking that first step is so important, you know. So there's going to be lots of first steps or second or third or fourth steps that you could become aware of today. I hope you can come to Justin Dillon and my workshop. It's going to be in here about how each one of us are consumers and what practical steps we can take to speak prophetically to a marketplace and say, it's not okay for slavery and abuse to occur to give me a cheap product. But there's lots of practical things. But I want to encourage you to stand in that tragic gap between the dream of how the world could be and the reality of what it is. What the enslaved need are people who commit themselves to stay in that gap with their hearts open and broken and with their minds open, finding new ways of doing things. It was just so fantastic to hear the examples of the innovative things that are going on. Just with open minds of how we can change things. It will require a deep sense of calling. It requires sacrifice. It requires letting go of those narratives in our head that play out every single day for how our lives ought to be turning out. And on many occasions, it requires us to swallow our fear and stay standing in that gap nonetheless. And there's a word for facing fears and staying the course that we've committed to, and the word is bravery. Bravery is not the absence of fear. It is staying the course despite your fears. Now, the thing in the Bible that God says most often when He meets human beings is, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. I'm going to be with you. You are not to fear. Fear is the thing that stops us more than anything else. I want to show you a video now, just a short one-minute video. And you're going to hear from Sue Hannah later on in the day from an organization called Hagar in Cambodia. This is from one of the women who was looked after by Hagar there and who works in the organization that makes products for Traders One. And so I want to just play this and then we'll wrap up.
ខ្ញុំបាទមកគិតពីអាយុ26 6 ឆ្នាំពីមុនមកខ្ញុំមិនតាន់បានមកនៅក្នុងអង្គការហាកាខ្ញុំស្នាក់នៅខាងក្រៅខ្ញុំមានអាជីវភាពពិបាកដូចជាខ្ញុំខ្វះខាតហើយខ្ញុំជាកូនកំព្រាហើយសំខាន់គេបានចាប់ខ្ញុំយកទៅលក់ហើយហាកាបានផ្ដល់នៃជាឲ្យគេកន្លែងនេះស្នាក់នៅល្អមែនតែន ដើម្បីឲ្យជីវិតខ្ញុំបានល្អហើយពេលឥឡូវនេះខ្ញុំឡាយទៅជាបុគ្គលិកខ្ញុំបានប្រាក់ខែដើម្បីចំខ្ញុំហើយនឹងកូនស្រីរបស់ខ្ញុំពីមុនហើយឥឡូវនេះខុសនេះថ្ងៃមិនតែនអពីពូពីមុនខ្ញុំមកចូលចិត្តមនុស្សប៉ុន្តែឥឡូវខ្ញុំចូលចិត្តមនុស្សហើយខ្ញុំមានចិត្តថា
I love how she sums up the change to her life. She had so much legitimately to fear. And she says, now I am brave. These bags are what that organization makes. And instead of a bag that can be made in a sweatshop or even an instrument of human slavery, they're the absolute opposite of that. They show lives redeemed and of the restoration of dignity and bravery. So as I finish, God bless you, God disturb you. That disturbing will break you. I hope God calls you, and if He calls you to do something, He will equip you, He will be with you. So together with all of His people, we can proclaim good news to the poor and freedom to the captives. Thank you.
Thanks, Nathan. Thank you, Nathan. Nathan reminds me, before we go on here, that I think it's good to just take that moment to acknowledge that we are addressing the condition of the human heart in addressing an issue like this, and that is part of bringing this issue into the personal place of saying what I might be compelled to do. As he said, God disturb you, I think of how people said, well, how did you get involved in this issue? And I said, well, it wasn't that I got a lot of good night's rest. Actually, once I heard about this, Gary Haugen from the International Justice Mission said, I think you have a responsibility to do something with that. And I remember many a night where I was actually kept awake and really feel like this has been an issue that I wrestle with. And that's why we're up here today, not because, again, as we've got it all figured out, but because we like asking the questions to see what comes from that. This conference is a great example of just bringing people together, the volunteers that are here to serve you today. All of us are saying, what can I do? I've brought three people before you this morning so far, Lieutenant John Vanek, Brad Miles, and then Nathan George, about folks who have actually said we are taking our own lives and inserting them in the story. And I was thinking about how when John and Brad talked about us in the human trafficking community think this or have seen this, well, you are all in that community now. You are part of the constituents that can ask the media to start to shine more light on this. You are the constituents that can go learn more from Trade as One about our consumer choices. And there is something very empowering in that. I remember when I first started looking at this issue and I said, well, right now I feel like I can either pray or I can pay to have somebody else do the work. And what we have been doing is trying to stand in that gap of saying, let's build out the spectrum of what we can do. So that is what today is all about, and you will see from the variety of folks in the breakout sessions that we have folks who are here talking about the links of human trafficking with foster care and what happens with kids when they graduate out of the foster care system, with missing children, and what happens when people are abducted. I know that's fresh on our minds here in the Bay Area when the Amber Alert was turned on this week, and you could see it as you drove the freeways of the Bay Area. There are a lot of linkages with this issue that a lot of people are saying, oh, I didn't realize that that also is linked with this issue. So yes, it makes the issue seem dynamic and large and hard to get your hands around, but it also means that a lot of people who have never been in the same room together before are actually starting to talk. And I really do believe, like Nathan mentioned, that it takes a community like that meeting together, not individualistic results that are going to bring about what we would like to see for the Bay Area, and that is a slave-free Bay Area. Speaking right from our own backyard, the Not for Sale campaign was founded here in San Francisco with Dr. David Badstone. I've long known that he's a professor at the University of San Francisco, but I recently found out he's a professor of ethics. And I actually love that this falls underneath that, that he is actually mobilizing young folks in the academic world to really consider not only this issue as a subject to be studied, but an issue of ethics. David has written a book called Not for Sale, The Return of the Global Slave Trade, and he has traveled the world, as Nathan put it, to really smell what a dollar a day to live on smells like and feels like. So David speaks from firsthand experience of doing brothel raids and investigations, wearing undercover cameras. His experience is really from the front lines. So knowing that David is one of the folks who has really started to pave the way on what is happening right here in our own backyard, it is a great privilege for us to welcome this morning Dr. David Bathstone.
Wow, a lot's happened in the last 2 years since we had the last Freedom Summit. Just the fact that so many of you who are here are ready now to take action. It's not about awareness anymore. It's about engagement. And that's what I want to focus on. It's not about, hey, give you a new statistic that will really blow you away, but what can I do about this here in the Bay Area? Well, I've been on the phone last night and this morning with Alameda County officials. Got some great news that there's been a raid right here in the East Bay, Hayward up to Oakland. A big hand. Multi-house brothel raid, 8 traffickers put in jail, 10 girls rescued and getting services this morning. How things have changed. I tell you, I have to give real kudos to the Alameda District Attorney's Office, as well as the Hayward Police, for pursuing a tip that was created by a citizen investigator. Someone in their own community that noted that something was strange in a house down the street, that men were arriving at all different hours of the night. They occasionally saw young girls that weren't allowed to leave, and therefore they called the local police consistently, persistently, until they investigated and found that it was a part of a ring throughout the Bay Area, stretching from Alameda County to Santa Clara County. What can we do? A lot. Now, a couple of things about this case that we need to pay attention to. I mentioned 8 traffickers went to jail, and 10 young women are receiving services. Not treated as criminals, but treated as human beings with dignity that need assistance. It's a big leap forward. You notice I didn't say anything about any Johns being arrested or going to jail. That is a big loophole that allows those who are driving the demand to get by without any accountability, and we need to change that as well. What a difference a couple of years makes. Perhaps many of you were here when I related to you beginning the Not For Sale effort in the San Francisco Bay Area after I inadvertently stumbled on a human trafficking ring in a restaurant here in the Bay Area that had brought hundreds of kids from the country of India into the United States for the express purpose of forced labor. First in a restaurant washing dishes, then being sent out to fruit and vegetable fields, brothels, construction crews here in the Bay Area. It was a shock to me, even more so because I used to go to that restaurant every couple of weeks. One of my favorite restaurants in the Bay Area, and here right under my nose, is the enslavement of young teenage kids from India. When I came back from a global investigation, I took a year off from the university, I came back and I was really struck by the invisibility of that which was only an inch below the surface. So how do you create something that is visible? How do you expose the visibility of it when it's just barely invisible? Well, I first turned to my university students and trained them to be investigators at the University of San Francisco. They were only 19 or 20 years old, and I had to put a lot of protocols in place. First, all we wanted to do was document what had happened in the Bay Area over the last decade, the last 10 years. We stumbled into a case at the Bay Bridge that some of you cross when you commute into San Francisco. We discovered 70 men from Thailand had been brought here to work against their will, forced labor on that bridge. We discovered that there were construction crews all up and down the Bay Area, fruit and vegetable fields out in Pescadero, Half Moon Bay, out in the valleys where many of us live. We discover that there are brothels in your neighborhoods all over the Bay Area. Well, as we began to document cases that maybe not had previously been identified as human trafficking or modern slavery, my students began to stumble into live cases. And I had to create some real protocols because I wanted to remind them that they were not the FBI. And also, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm kind of tired of a phenomenon I call dumb activism. The world is full of dumb activists, and we're not going to end modern slavery with anything short of smart activism. So, one thing I said to them is that you cannot go within 100 yards of what you suspect might be a trafficking ring. If you were to get hurt, first off, your parents would not like me very much. And secondly, the New York Times would have a cover story tomorrow that would say, moron professor throws his students in a human trafficking ring. Now, I get called a moron a lot, and I'm used to it, and I don't mind it too much. But I don't like it when it undermines the replicability, that is, the ability to replicate and otherwise spread a movement. There would not be students, there would not be investigators in other cities around the United States that would be enabled to do that work. So my students were able to find on the internet an advertisement for an acupuncture center one block off of Union Square. Fresh new Asian girls off the boat every week. It was almost like produce from Argentina or Chile. And the pictures of these girls certainly betrayed the fact that it was not about acupuncture they were selling. So my students dutifully kept their 100-yard barrier and began doing surveillance from across the street in a Banana Republic store on Sutter Street. And they saw these men going in. They saw people coming out, security force and other people who were looked like they were in charge, locking the door, locking them in. No young girl left. So we gathered all this data, and we took it at that time to the district attorney's office in our city. And the response that we got was that, you know what? We don't have enough of a resource on our force to pursue that. And we're not sure what we would arrest them on. Now, this is 4.5 years ago. And we're not even sure we would know whether or not they came willfully from their countries in Asia here. And how would we pursue that? We'd have to send investigators over to Asia to pursue that case. Well, I had made a commitment to our students that they, not being expendable, did not know that I had a staff of expendable people to Not For Sale campaign. And so two of us, myself and co-founder Kike Bassan, we went in acting as if we were men coming from out of town on a business trip, and that we were wanting 6 young girls to come to our hotel at Union Square that night. The mommy saw them, the trafficker said, I'm sorry, sir, but the girls don't leave here. You'll have to bring your party here. We said, you know, it'd be so much better if they could come to our hotel. We'll pay you 10 times what we normally get. We're on a business expense account. We don't care. The mommy saw him said, I'm sorry, sir. The girls do not leave here. Another red flag. And we have a hidden camera on. We ask how much it's going to cost for the night, what we get. We have the transaction on video. And then we walk out. And as I'm walking out, I look across the street in front of the Banana Republic, and there are my students in a parked car with a video camera. Smart activism, they got it on camera. And I'll tell you, those students led to the San Francisco police raiding that place and shutting it down. Well, smart activism today is not sending anyone undercover. I don't want to go undercover anymore. I felt too slimy. But it's great police officers like Lieutenant John Vanek and members of the FBI that we work with very closely, members of task forces all over the country who will pursue justice. But on the other hand, there are not enough Lieutenant John Vaneks around. I want to be honest with you. What's going on in police forces, be it the FBI or local vice squads all over the country, are limited resources, the dwindling of resources that already were minimal. And so if we hope that by simply sending in more phone calls or being able to go and visit our local police department, that somehow they're going to be able to respond to all that, I think we're fooling ourselves. That's not a smart strategy forward. We need lots of multiple strategies, but we need citizens who will be engaged in a way that is thoughtful, in a gauge that is informed, in a way that actually is able to create what we call, and not for sale, a smart tip, so that we qualify, we otherwise understand what's happening in our community. It's unlikely that you will just simply one day turn around and look and see that there's a trafficking operation down the block. But there would probably be a series of information that you would need that would help you increase your awareness and your engagement. That's why we have an academy where we train citizen investigators. You get different levels of certification. It's just as if you were going to attack any other problem. I lived up in the East Bay for many years, and one day my shower started leaking, so I called a plumber, and this could only happen in Berkeley, where the plumber showed up, went in and looked at my shower, and as she was lifting her head, she hit her head on the shower head. And as she starts walking out, and I said, "Wait, did you fix the shower?" She said, "No, it's got bad karma." Bad karma? You're just a bad plumber. We need smart activists. We need smart activists who be trained. And so I invite you to go deeper in your commitment. Some of you, this is not your calling or your passion. This is not something you want to pursue. But if you do, get smarter. Because it requires of us to really begin to see the patterns and how we as citizens can partner with law enforcement in our community. Young Saskia Wissert came to the academy that we have in San Francisco last year. She was headed to Cape Town for the World Cup, was going to participate with other not-for-sale people and trying to bring about awareness at the World Cup of the kind of trafficking that happens at major events. She got trained in protocol so that when she met a young 15-year-old Nigerian girl on a street corner, and that young girl shared with her that she had been brought to South Africa for the World Cup along with 12 other young teenage girls from Nigeria to sell their bodies on the streets of Cape Town for the World Cup. Saskia says her first inclination was to take that young girl, throw her in a car, and drive off and rescue her. It's dumb activism. Because you have traffickers who see that young girl as their property. They see that young girl as someone they are going to make a large sum of profit off of. And they will pursue her. And now they're going to pursue you as well. So Saskia did what we teach as protocol. Get all the information, write it down. How many girls are with you? Where are you being kept? Can you tell me anything about those who are holding you? She then went to the Federal Police of South Africa in charge of trafficking, with whom she had built a trusted relationship. As a citizen investigator, you learn how to build those trusted relationships. Pass that smart tip over to that federal agency, mapped out an intervention strategy. They shut that operation down and threw 8 Nigerian traffickers in jail, rescued 13 young girls in Nigeria. That's smart activism. And it involves us taking a further step, our compassion. You see, when I first went around the globe to understand how human trafficking works, I met lots of victims and sometimes survivors. And at the end of the stream, we want to be able to pull them out as they drown or they're flailing. That's compassion. And we need more compassionate ministries. We need more compassionate organizations that can provide care to those who get ensnared. But at some point, if we do not walk upstream and address the reasons why so many millions of people are falling in slavery, then we are not practicing justice. We need compassion. We need justice. So what does justice look like? Justice looks like addressing the demand side for the sex industry that reaches from San Francisco to the globe. Justice means finding ways that I personally, today, can start changing the way that I live so that others can simply live. Now, one thing that surprised me when I went to Africa and Asia and Latin America is my link to slavery, not just because I live in an area of the world, the United States and San Francisco, that is a conduit for tens of thousands of trafficking victims over the last decade, but also because every day I participate in the global slave trade in ways that I was never aware of. It took me going to Africa to learn that the Firestone tires on my car were likely linked to the global slave trade. I see that Firestone Bridgestone is actually sponsoring the Super Bowl. And it just makes me shudder because I learned there's 21 lawsuits for slavery against the Bridgestone plantation in Liberia today. 21 lawsuits for slavery. So, what does it mean for a smart activist then to be able to engage their lifestyle in a very personal way? Our team began to look at the factors that go into making any product that we use. We came up with 40 different factors, and then we, with that formula of 40 factors of ways to prevent human trafficking and forced labor to happen in the supply chain of a product, you come up with a grade. You're very familiar with that grading system if you ever went to school. It's an A, a B, a C, a D, or an F. Well, you take that information and then you have to make it very accessible to you as a consumer, to you as a civilian. So therefore, we began working with a wonderful handheld mobile company here in Silicon Valley called Apple. And we created an app, so today you are able to get this as you are shopping, the grade that you're looking at. You know, Reid Hoffman, who started LinkedIn, he made a really astute comment one time that if you're not embarrassed by the first release of your software, you release too late. So, Free to Work 1.0, it gives you the information you need by company or by product. The next delivery of that in about 7 weeks will be a barcode. You just scan the barcode on a product, up will pop the grade. The next version, 8 weeks later, is that you can then make a comment back to the product owner, to the company, and say, I bought your product today because of the fact you respect the lives of the people who made that product. So I'm wearing Levi jeans today. I feel really great about that because they get a B. They enable people to be free to work. If you're wearing Hanes undershirts today, take it off right now. They get a D minus. Why would you wear that knowing what you know now, right? Take it off. I'll wait. That's smart activism. How many people have downloaded the Free to Work app? Let me see your hands. Look around. Those are abolitionists. A big hand for them. And how many are going to download it within the next 24 hours? About a bigger hand for them. Come on. That's smart activism. All right, I realize not everyone has an iPhone. Maybe some of you have Droids and some of you have BlackBerry. Great news. One of the big Silicon Valley companies, Juniper Networks, has partnered with Not For Sale. Their engineers are going to help us be able to send it to all three handhelds within the next 2 months. So if you've got a Droid, you've got a BlackBerry, you've got an iPhone, you can start working for justice. If you've got a Nokia, get rid of it. It's outdated. Okay, so we take one step. You take a step, and then you begin learning lots of things. Why do companies not then step forward and say, we are slave-free? It's because of the environment, litigious, that means lots of lawsuits that are making lawyers somewhat comfortable, and the media environment of frenzy that addresses a corporate environment. So if you're a CEO of a major company, you are very reticent to say, I am slave-free. Just like at my university, the University of San Francisco, we don't say we're racism-free Because what's going to happen tomorrow? There are factors we cannot control. We have a complexity of students, just like a company has a complexity of factors that go into their supply chain. So we have changed that language, being a smarter activist, hopefully, by saying we will have zero tolerance in our company. We have all the protocols in place, which gives them a grade that would be high or low, that we make sure that we monitor wherever our products are made. We do spot checks. You imagine if you call China and say, we're coming over on April 15th, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. We're going to check out your factory. What's going to happen on April 15th? So spot checking, also other ways that you ensure that there is zero tolerance in our company. And when there is a glitch, when there is something you cannot control, then you have the mechanism and the expressed intention, and you deliver on that to make sure that that child slave is no longer enslaved in your supply chain. That's what it means to have zero tolerance. That's what gives you an A on free to work. I believe we need to change our language from slave free to zero tolerance, because we are preventing. I talked to the CEO of a major San Francisco company. He said, I'm really frightened of that whole world because you guys are setting me up for failure. You understand why? So what does it mean to talk about we will have zero tolerance in Alameda County for slavery? We will have zero tolerance in our company. My university, we're going to have zero tolerance in the ways that we procure, that is the way that we buy. We need to shift the way that we think about that. As I look around at how we're addressing child slavery and forced labor, it also frightens me somewhat of what I call a scattergun approach. The Department of Labor puts out statistics on certain industries like apparel, electronics, toys, and then makes comments about their slavery propensity. I don't think that's a very smart strategy, because then you never are able to give credit and reward those companies in those industries that are actually doing remarkable things to address our supply chain. It's too scattergun. When we can down to a company, grade that company, and you get that as you're shopping, that's targeted smart activism. You see, dumb activism is standing in front of Starbucks today with a painted sign saying, I'm against globalization. What does that mean? I'm serious. I'm like, me too, but I got to get the coffee and cream. Am I globalizing now? Or smart activism is refining then the impact. It's called creating linkage. So how do I create linkage where I live, my daily behavior, how do I create that linkage to a broader world, my backyard, the global community? What does that linkage look like? Well, we are living at a time when we are able to change the world with very simple decisions, very simple solutions. If at the end of the day today, you feel like you had a fire hose stuck up to the side of your head, and you go, what can I do next? I mean, it seems so big to me, and what can I do? I'm one person. My encouragement to you is do that one thing that may be very simple, but that you know is within your daily pattern of life. Do that one thing. And do that thing even if you're not sure whether it's the right thing, because there is a great aphorism from Ghana that says we don't mind stumbling because it makes us move forward more quickly. So do that one thing, and you know what? You open a door to another thing. You open the door to a second act. You all are members of schools and churches, sports clubs. You're all members of communities. And your decisions have a ripple effect. Your decisions can have a major impact. We began looking at the ways that young girls in Cambodia, I leave for Cambodia in a couple days, and there's so many young boys and girls are trafficked in the commercial sex industry within Southeast Asia and all over the world. So we began addressing the causes for that. And we decided to then come up with a creative innovation. You see, I'm convinced, and some of you go to Stanford, some of you go to Berkeley, and some of you are smart enough to go to USF. But wherever you go to school or are still learning, see, I'm convinced that a college degree is a license to go learn for the rest of your life. Right? It's not a, okay, now shut your brain off. You did a really good job over 4 years. I'm not so worried about those of you today who are my age and want to keep learning or older. My mother and father are here. They're 82. They're still learning every day. I'm really excited about being with them because they're energetic. I got 19-year-old students. They're brain dead. So how do we keep learning? How do we keep, you know, are we smarter this week than we were last week? That's the movement has to be, right? Always questioning orthodoxy. Always questioning the way we used to do it. Because the fact of the matter is, we'll have a Freedom Summit in 20 years. I will look a little bit older. I will come up here and I will tell you how bad trafficking is in the world today. And we'll shake our head. I don't want to do that. But if we keep doing the same things over and over again, we're going to get the same results. We need innovation. We need new models. What a wonderful time to join a movement because we're looking for pioneers to create new models. I was really proud of my team then. We bought a factory in Cambodia. We started with 10 women who were coming out of shelters. We went to the different shelters in Phnom Penh and in Cambodia at large and said, look, it's wonderful that you're helping them restore a sense of dignity to their lives. What does their security, their future look like? We'd love to be able to give them an opportunity to work in a dignified way. You see, you've heard this aphorism, you teach a man to fish, he'll eat for a day. You teach her how to fish, she'll eat for a lifetime. It's not true. Well, maybe it's half true. Because you give someone fish to eat when they're hungry, that's survival. If you teach them how to fish, that's sustenance, perhaps. But they still do not have access to the pond. If you don't have equity in the pond, you're always vulnerable to those who own the pond. How do we bring justice to those who have no access to the pond? So with the factory in Cambodia, we said, look, for every woman who comes and works here, after 6 months, we'll give you shares of stock. You'll become an owner of the company. And at that moment that you choose to leave, it's convertible into cash that will be your security moving forward. When you come work at the factory, you're a seamstress to begin with. But we look for skills. Wow, you're really good in accounting. You're really good in design. And some women say, hey, leave me alone. I just want to sew. You're really good at sewing. We began with 10 women, and we started making those bags that are made out of rice bags. You seen those person made out of rice bags? I personally think they're very ugly, but the French like them. And I quickly came to a business conclusion. There's only so many French in the world. We need to expand our product line. Now, I have a very strange appointment at the University of San Francisco. One is they only expect me to be there 1 day a week. It's a great job if you can get it. It's because the University of San Francisco is a Jesuit school committed to social justice. They so believe in what I do. They say, look, if you can be here on that day, get your teaching, and then work with students, we're happy. So what does it mean to then get engaged in this? I started to think about it. I get to teach in ethics, and I get to teach in business. Never shall the two meet, you might say. But why? You see, I was at Westmont College. It was a Christian college, and we'd have chapel. And I have speakers coming in, and they talk about the call to the gospel. They call about changing your life with mission, and you've been called to something special if you're going into ministry, social work, or the pastoral work. And I'd be sitting there thinking, thank God I'm going to go into business, because that sounds really difficult, and I'd be poor. What Bible are they reading anyway? Because you have a business skill, you're an entrepreneur, you've got legal skills, you've got healthcare skills, therefore you have no obligation to help a broken world. Therefore, we have in the developed world today, we have social workers trying to be entrepreneurs. They're terrible at it. Just like if you're an entrepreneur and you want to be involved in this movement, I don't want you to go try and be someone in Calcutta working with someone healing wounds. I want you to use your entrepreneurial skills to create wealth for the many. So here's a secret, whether you're going to start a business in Phnom Penh or whether you want to start a business in Fremont. The best way to start a business is when you already have customers. Now, that's not rocket science, is it? That is, oftentimes people start a company because they've had this dream to make this little doll, and the doll sings certain songs, and I hope people will buy it one day. Find deluded people who want to buy that little doll. And then figure out how to produce it. So, as we began to look at our product line, we say, okay, what is it that Americans buy, particularly in universities and in religious communities? Because those are two demographics, two sets of people who really care about the world and changing it. There's some value associated with transformation in those two communities. Well, for whatever reason, people who are in religious communities and people who are in universities, they like to buy t-shirts. I mean, particularly the social justice, want to change the world types, you don't have a movement until you get your t-shirt. You know, we've thought about having this campaign, Activism Beyond the T-Shirt, but yeah, we don't want to bother that. So we said, well, look it. We started talking to the guys from Third Day. It's a band out of Georgia. They're not too bad. They're not too bad. And we said, look, you sell lots of t-shirts. How about we create our own brand? Because we're asking people to take their hands off and throw them on the ground in churches and universities all over the country. Why don't we create our own free-to-rock brand? And then you can put your, you know, band name or your school name, your activist name, whatever, your church name on the t-shirt. It's a free-to-rock branded shirt. And Third Day said, we'll do it for all of our apparel. And then 10th Avenue North, another great band, they signed on. And then Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, who probably some of you are not going to go see them at a club, but they're really cool people anyway. How great is it now, a year later, I'm going to Phnom Penh next week, and I get to look at 100 women sewing at machines, freed from slavery, who now have a gainful employment because we've changed the way that we buy. See, that's bringing about innovation. That's bringing about a change. That's bringing about, and it's connected to my life. When I'm wearing a free-to-rock shirt, oh, I have these great Converse All-Stars, which really are not Converse All-Stars. We sell them at our Freedom store over in Half Moon Bay, or you can get them online. They're all only $49.99. But what's so great is I'm walking over at USF, and someone goes, hey, Dr. Bastone, like your Converse. I go, hey, they're not Converse. They're made by women free from slavery in India, and I feel really good about the fact that they're fashionable. They're called Ethica shoes, and they are cool. Why would I go out and buy Converse when I'm very unclear about their supply chain? In fact, their grade is not something to go home and show mom and dad. When I can buy Ethica shoes and I can feel great about the way I wear, right? I can wear a free-to-rock shirt. You see where I'm headed with this? So, you know, in the lobby, you'll see lots of products made by our projects around the world at the Freedom Store. That's another way of addressing supply chain. So that when I do go and visit the Gap, as I do next week, they're doing a pretty good job. But if anyone there were to say to me, you know, it's just so complex, I don't know how we would say, you know what? We've got our own t-shirt company. And actually, everyone is getting equity in the company. They're getting paid fairly. There's childcare. And they're free to follow a dignity, to follow the life that they were given, to pursue the great gift of being a human being. I might not say all of that, but some of that I might say on Monday. So it's not only about throwing stones. Smart activists look for innovative solutions, right? It's easy to sit back and criticize, but do it yourself first. So while you're addressing a prophetic voice, also start getting like Mary and Martha, you know, on the ground doing stuff. It takes both. It takes a new way of thinking. Well, there are enough skills and talents in this room that go beyond anything that I'm ever going to reach in my lifetime. I just got one of those new spinner bikes. You ever seen those things? They're really cool. I got one, and I got it in a package, and it came, and they wanted me to put it together. So I made a quick executive decision. I turned to my son, Jesse, who's 15, and said, hey, Jesse, I'll pay you $25 to put that thing together before I get home today. That's because Jesse's got skills that I just don't have. You do not want me fixing anything broken. It's got bad karma. I'm convinced of it. Your house. But that's why we need everyone in this movement. That's why you're here, because you have been uniquely gifted. You have a passion, you have a skill that probably will only intersect with mine at different places, different times. But a movement, you know, I came out of Silicon Valley. I was part of a startup culture and magazine called Business 2.0. And so when Not For Sale started, I came up with this term called open source activism. Open source activism is a sense that, you know what, we can only create platforms. You've got to write the code. Free to work, the app is a platform, but you've got to write the code. How you transmit that, how you relay that into your community. We want students, we want athletes, you know, I got a great call from Jeremy Affelt, one of the World Series heroes. You know, Jeremy Affelt and Matt Cain are now throwing strikes for Not For Sale. I don't want them to go down to Peru and start a bakery. I want them to be on the mound talking about why they're freeing kids so they can play and they aren't able to play today. Whereas I'm free to play as an athlete. So we're working with some of the major technology companies to create an app. And you would be able, for whoever your favorite player is, I don't care who it is, you are able to say for 10 cents for every hit, $1 for every save, $3 for every strikeout, whatever it might be as a fan, and we will have team free-to-play players, but also as a fan then, we go to those players, Ichiro in Seattle. You know what? 2,000 people give 10 cents every time you get a hit so they can free kids from slavery. Why don't you match them? Athletes doing what they do best. The Stanford tennis team, every time you get an ace this year, give $1 so that kids can be free to play. Other teams will start saying, well, that is really cool. There's kids now. What do you mean by free to play? There's over 30 million people in slavery today. So using your gift, your skill, your talent. One of my favorite stories this last year was a group of high school students from Toronto who called us up and said, you know what, we want to do something really unique. We want to have a fashion show, and it's going to feature free to work, but what we want to do is we want to make all our own clothes. And then we're going to have all our own models from the high school. And then we're going to have all of our families come, and they had a big fashion show. They got this downtown hotel. Through ticket sales and through the sale of the clothes, they raised $50,000. High school students do their own fashion show to fight slavery in North America, to pay for investigations, to pay for different ways to get people out of slavery. So I don't care what your age is or what your gift is, what your skill is, you are needed in the movement. That's been our whole philosophy. In fact, it's really terrific. I just looked at our year-end kind of schematic and Not For Sale. $2 out of $3 we get come from individuals online. It's like kind of Obama-esque or something. We don't get money from big corporations. We get very little. We get very little from the government. But it's individuals who say, I want to be a part of that. And that's what it's going to take to end slavery. What's your part? What are you going to do to bring about a change in the lives of others? Because by doing nothing, we allow them to stay in their places of bondage. There are individuals out there, as John Vanek said, by your presence here, by your activities, you are freeing people. Take that one step at the end of the day today. If it means getting better educated, go to the lobby at the Not For Sale tables and academy sign up. Every church here, every school should send at least one representative to an academy so that you can be equipped in your community to say, we will not stand by quietly when slavery happens in this community. It's about shopping differently, buying differently, telling the story of who you are differently. It's about praying differently, that you can be used every day. Not that they'll raise up Gary Hogan, I love Gary, but we don't need more Garys, we need more you. You hear what I'm saying? It's about using the passion, the gift, the skills, because you have been given a special purpose that is no one else's but yours, and you need to deploy that. And what's great about that, in the deployment of that, you reach your fulfillment, but you give someone else redemption, someone else freedom, someone else the ability to pursue their destiny. You know, it's a time and place to find a future beyond the dreams that we hold as what makes us valuable. For those of us that have a spiritual path, we're told every day when we turn on the TV or we go to work that what makes us valuable is what we own, or the lack of cellulite on our bodies, or a host of things that are really trivial at the end of the day. It's taking that step. For me, I'm a writer. My readers don't always agree with me, but I write books. And so I said, what can I do to fight slavery after finding it in downtown Berkeley? I decided to go around the world and write a book. But when I took that step, I met this woman named Khru Nam in Thailand, who had 27 kids she rescued out of the brothels of Chiang Mai, was now living in a field on the border between Laos, Burma. And so that step is like, oh gosh, why did I take that step? All right, Khru Nam, I'll build a house for you and your kids. That was all I was committing to. Okay, step two, right? Be careful when you take step two, because everything accelerates, right? When someone says to you, you know, God will reveal to you what will happen next, be wary. You're being set up. Do not move. Shut your eyes. Stop hearing. You're on the path to significance, and that's scary. All right, Khru Nam, I'll help 27 kids, because when people buy my book, I've got a large extended family. When they buy it, they'll say, what can we do? I say, help me build a home for Khru Nam and her kids. And so I'm writing. I'm in chapter two. I get a call from Khru Nam. He said, David, you know, there's 27 kids. Now there's 53. And I'm thinking, this better be one darn good book. So I'm writing with new seriousness, new dedication. I'm in chapter six. About 3 months later, I get a call from Khru Nam. David, there's now 88 kids I've rescued. And I'm like, slow down on the rescues already. 127 kids later, I got to start the not-for-sale organization, because I know I can't write that well. We needed more resources. We need more involvement. And you go to the north of Thailand, where I go next week, I'm going to see 200 kids in that area who are getting a place to live. They're getting education. They're getting health care. It's because we believe we can do something. If someone says, you can't do anything about that, we'll tell them, well, get out of my way, because I am going to do something with my new Converse All-Stars. We're here because we believe that we can be a part of the great plan of setting the captives free. We're here because we know we have a role. I don't know how you got here. Who brought you here? Who kind of put you in the trunk of a car and brought you? By the way, I have investigators who can look into that. But you came because you felt you had a purpose. Do not let that die. Act on that today, and that act is going to lead to a freedom that we can sing together, free at last, free at last. Thank God we're all free at last tonight. Amen.